In the following live session recording, Nick Duke, state missionary with Georgia Baptist Mission Board, talks about church sound technicians. Church sound technicians have a tough job. The technology changes rapidly and comprehensive training is often hard to find. Fortunately, the Georgia Baptist Mission Board is making changes to allow these kinds of resources to be more readily available to churches and their teams. This session will be a discussion on the resources, gear, practices, and ongoing training that is needed to be effective as a church sound technician. Let's join Nick now.
That's good. So, a lot of what I'm going to do today is just kind of going through, talking through, like, what is our job as sound guys? And I know I'm talking to some worship leaders, but I think it's really important as worship leaders and pastors to unify your team from the front of the room to the back of the room, and be able to speak the same language. There's a lot of tension that gets put into our Sunday mornings when there's a misunderstanding between not speaking the same language, not seeing the same perspective, and that's just really unfortunate to me. I think we should all be serving the same goal and serving the same mission, and so if there's bickering and stuff like that just because of a lack of understanding, there's a problem there. And so I'm excited that you guys are here, because I'm hoping that translates to your guys' situation. So we're gonna be talking about just some basics of audio, reinforcing probably some of what you already know, but maybe learning a couple things along the way, and just kind of talking what's the point and the purpose. And then I'll leave a lot of space at the end so we can just chat about your situation, and ways that we can, something that you can tangibly take home with you, as far as takeaways and that sort of thing. So first thing is, what is our goal? What's the point of having an audio mixer? I'd love to hear your perspective and a worship leader perspective.
As far as having an audio mixer?
Yeah, I mean, what's the point?
Man, you need
a broad brush.
A cohesive sound across the whole frequency spectrum, you know what I'm saying? I mean, you've got shrill singers over here, and then you've got the boom boom over here, and you just need to kind of flatten it out. So that's what we're there. We're here, there. And I can, and a good sound guy can really enhance the worship service. There's some little tricks here and there that you just follow the service, and the mix breathes. You got to make the mix breathe, and if it doesn't breathe and just stays static, then it's just going nowhere.
That's right.
But what are we there for? I mean, I'm there to make them sound good. That's why I'm there.
Okay. Cool. Give me your perspective. What's the matter of your guys' job?
Well, in our situation, and with the training level our people have, the main goal is not to be for the sound not to be distracting, to make sure that, you know, that everything's heard, nothing's too loud,
right,
and that you know, that way the focus can be on the Lord and not on feedback and whatever else might be going on.
No doubt. Yeah, so there's a level of engagement that takes place when there's no distractions, when all of the pieces of the puzzle blend together and serve to engage a congregation and translate what the musicians are doing on the platform, taking all that together, blending it all together, making it sonically pleasing to the ear. And then come out of your main speakers in a way that engages the congregation. That's what I want to like underline and highlight. Is our job is to engage the congregation in worship. And so I really treat anytime I'm a worship leader myself. And the only reason I learned sound is because I wanted to have a good sound, and I never was able to get that out of some of the guys that I had under my leadership. And so I was like, I'm gonna learn sound, and I fell in love with it, and I really have enjoyed it a lot. And so part of what I get to do every day for my job is to do both, and so to teach sound and to teach worship, and I see this as very similar jobs. Now one is a fully serving at role where you stay, like the more you stay in the background, the better you've done. Kind of what you're saying, like my job is to help them translate what they're trying to get off the platform well. And the other one is very vocal and very out front, and so they're two different things completely, but same goal. My job is to translate music in a way that's going to engage a congregation in worship and have them be rid of all the distractions that would be there in a way that puts heart and puts head with heart and help us to feel what we know is true in the scriptures. And so, so our job is to blend all that together, to put it all together into engage our congregation. I treat my sound guy like I treat any one of my musicians. Anytime I travel and do music somewhere, my sound guy is a band member of mine. Because how could I, so if you went and led worship at another church, and you just rolled in and expected them to know your stuff and know how you operated, it would be a disaster. I mean, expect that band just to know how you led us. It takes time to blend that together and to be a part of that as a musician. So a sound guy is very much a part of that. This is a musical instrument. It takes an ear, a musical ear, to know what it should sound like in order to manipulate all this stuff to get it to sound right. And so it really is a musician thing. I mean, against any sort of... I'm not saying that video isn't artistry. It absolutely is artistry. But sound is a musician artistry, where you have to know it sounds good. You know, you have to have a goal in mind in order to get that sound to sound that way. Does that make sense? All right. So that's the goal. The goal is to engage our congregation. So we're going to talk quickly about how sound works. And you guys, this is probably going to be like entry level for you. Again, last week we were talking, and the guy like had no clue. So sound. So we have what is this?
Speaker.
A speaker, right? So we have speakers and we have microphones, right? So we have sources and we have projection of said sources. So we have, this is essentially, if I took all these little components off of, this is a standard SM58 microphone that everybody from Aerosmith to you name it has sung in one of these. If I took the capsule off of this and took all that little foam off of it, it would look very similar to what the little tiny speakers in this look like. They're just little coils. I'm sorry, they're just little cones that take in acoustical information and translate it onto a little magnet, which is electrical information, and translate that over a big long speaker microphone cable. It gets translated by this thing we call a mixing console back out of this into a big power amplifier, which then gets translated out. Everybody's familiar with that? Did I go through that too fast? Familiar with that enough? Like, plug a microphone in, goes to the board, gets boosted a little bit, translated by all the EQs and all that stuff, comes out, big boom, we're there, right? So so we have speakers and microphones, but one of the cool things that when I went to school for audio technology, my professor did for us to kind of illustrate that point is he plugged in a pair of headphones into the back of the console, and he just cranked up the gain and started singing into the headphones, and sound came out just like a microphone. It's all just copper wire, coils, and cones. That's really all it is. Now some sound better than others for certain different reasons, but that's essentially all it is. The only reason I bring that up is to kind of demystify some things. It's not some crazy arbitrary process that happens. It's just simple. How do we measure audio? Anybody know?
Decibels.
So that's our loudness measurement. What are some other measurements that we can take on audio?
We have the EQ, which is all the different ones, right? Getting them all.
Well, frequencies, right. So we have hertz, which are frequencies, and we have decibels, which are our volumes. And so I have a slide in a little bit that I'll get to, but that's just familiarizing terms, kind of getting those kinds of things in our head. So we have decibels, which are volumes, frequencies, which tell us where in that spectrum of sound that we're going to hear. Very good. Has anybody heard of this word, this phrase, gain structure? What is gain structure? We're getting a little deeper here. Gain structure.
Gain.
Yeah. So what is gain?
It's basically how much power you're applying to each channel. Is that?
Yeah, that's a great way to say that. Absolutely. The way I like to illustrate this a lot when I teach my audio classes is I like to say that audio flows like water. Imagine you had a fire hydrant in your front yard. And this is my fun little PowerPoint skills here. Imagine you had a fire hydrant in your front yard that had a spigot off of it, like a garden hose. And you took a garden hose and you hooked it up to your sprinkler in your front yard. There it is. what would happen if you cranked the spigot up all the way from a fire hydrant pressure through your garden hose to this?
Explode.
Something would explode, right? So there's too much pressure in that hose. So similarly, if I take an XLR cable and I plug it into the back of a console and plug it into a microphone, and I crank it up as much as it can go, something's not going to actually explode, but we're going to have something called distortion. That is an explosion of audio. Like that nothing is good of that unless it's in a guitar amp. That's a different subject altogether. But gain structure is how, like, what steps and what processes does the pressure or does the signal path go through in order to get from this acoustic source to this one? And so this is the gain structure of your system. So this is what pressure points go throughout your system. So we have the gain knob, which is at the top, which you were talking about. Every channel has a gain knob, right? So that's your spigot on the fire hydrant. That's controlling how much power we're getting from this guy and putting through our system. But the reason that's important is we have to send that signal off to a bunch of different places typically. So typically I'm going to take a pastor's mic and I'm going to put it to the nursery, to the choir monitors. We're going to put it into personal monitors like inner monitors or floor wedges or something like that. And so if you don't have appropriate pressure, if you barely put enough in there to hear it, then when you try to boost that junk all the way across your whole system, you're just going to get a lot of noise. It's going to sound like... You can barely hear it. Never mind. I was trying to boost that up where you could hear it. We hear a lot more noise. Let me do this. See if I can get something out of that. That's called a noise floor. So that what I'm doing is just putting useless gain into my system. That's just extra sound, extra noise that's going to happen into my system. Does that make sense? So gain structure is just talking about all the little points that it has to go through that the signal is going to get boosted to use for different purposes. Okay. Another point of gain is in your EQ. You boost and you add and subtract gain by adding and subtracting EQ. So for instance, let me just go to... So if I reduce the gain of the high frequency, the treble, that's reducing gain on a specific frequency of that channel. Does that make sense? And I've hooked this up earlier, and I think this woofer is blown because it's only coming out of here. So if it sounds really terrible, I'm sorry about that. So when we're going to get to EQ in just a second, but that is a gain point of your channel. So if you have a lot of gain boosted on your main preamp gain here, and then you start adding a lot of extra gain into your EQ, you can start experiencing distortion just by boosting all these extra things. Does that make sense? With me on that?
Is that the same as trim, or is it different?
Trim is a, like if you're in a complex system, trim is a way to get your gain structure set well here, and then it's basically a second point of adjustment.
Okay.
Beyond the main signal path. Does that make sense? So for instance, that would be helpful if I put my trim, if I wanted to put my trim, like if I wanted to have my gain right here, send it to nursery, I send it to choir monitors, and then I could put it in the path right here where I wanted to trim that down because it's blowing out their inner monitors or something like that. It's a trim within that signal path. And you really only experience those, well, I take it back. Some consoles call trim gain and they treat it very much the same. And that's just a terminology of the manufacturer. So some will call it that, and some will put it as the gain knob of a line level signal, which we'll talk about in just a second as well. I guess I can go ahead and say that. So this is called a mic level signal, meaning it's only going to give me a tiny little bit of signal out of this thing until I boost it on the gain. But if I hooked up a keyboard to that exact same signal, I'm sure you've experienced that before, it's going to go boom, like, because what's coming out of that keyboard is a line level signal. It's a much hotter signal. And so when you'll see a lot of times you can switch your preamp from, or you'll have two different inputs on the back. One is a mic level, one's a line level. They go ahead and trim your line level down to be appropriate for the signal path that way. Does that make sense? Cool. So that's gain structure is really just that. It's getting the pressures right in the hose of your system, so to speak. And then once it comes out, you're going to go to this. And inside of your speaker or inside of your speaker rack that you're for your main speakers, you have the big amplifiers. Those aren't preamplifiers; those are amplifiers, and those are really what's taking what would be a drip of a water hose and turning it into the Hoover Dam. And it's really boosting it from way down here to potential sound being way up here. Does that make sense? So that's what that is. That's what gain structure is. If you see that terminology, that's what that is. It's just dealing with the pressure, if we're using that analogy, the pressure of the system throughout your signal path. All right. Signal flow. This is slightly different, and this is dealing with the components within the path that the sound is traveling through. So one of the things is equalization. We call it EQ. Somebody give me a good definition of an EQ, if you can.
You get your different frequencies where the whatever is coming through sounds the best.
Yeah.
The clearest and...
Yeah, so they literally designed it because they had back when they were kind of developing all this technology, they designed it because they would take a good microphone and it sounds great on a voice, but then they put it on a piano and it kind of has this weird tone to it. So like, how can we shape that differently? So they created these what were called shelving EQs, and they would have like, it would just literally be these fixed positions of like low, high, or bass, or treble, or low frequency, high frequency, and you just boost or you cut. There was two different knobs. It's like a boost knob and a cut knob, that really kind of set the trajectory of what we now have, which is called a parametric EQ, which is like surgery for an audio source. You can really dig through and make something sound very particular, which is interesting. But yeah, you're exactly right. So it's adjusting gain based on frequency. So this is a little screenshot of an app that I use a lot when I'm mixing front of house or something that shows me the full spectrum. Does anybody know what the full spectrum is from this adjustment down here to this adjustment up here? What those frequencies are called? I remember what those frequency numbers are.
20 hertz, 20 kilohertz.
Thank you. Yeah, so 20 to 20K is what we'll see a lot of times. So that even if you buy like a set of Bose headphones, if you look on the package on the back, it'll say 20 to 20K. That's the reason is that's what the human ear at its best can hear. My kids can fully hear that. I've tested them on that. And my dad can't hear past like 13K right now. And we were messing with like a dog whistle thing at back at Christmas a while back. And we were like messing with like the little frequency sweep thing. And my dad couldn't hear past 13K, but I can still hear pretty much up to 20K-ish. But as you get older, the ability to hear that upper end starts to go down and down and down. And the more you're exposed to loud noises over the course of time, the faster that goes down. We had a sound guy at a church that will be that will remain nameless, that their sound guy was previously a helicopter repairman, and so like he was in extremely loud environments all the time. He just couldn't hear quite hardly anything, that's sad, but that's just how it is. And so knowing that information though even affects the way I'll mix a service. Like if I'm mixing for primarily an older congregation, I'm going to take a lot of the low end stuff down, and I'm going to make everything really bright because that's going to sound great to them. That's why I just have so many older folks complain about the subs in our church because that's what is so prevalent in their ears. That's all they can really hear. That's not all they can hear, but that's what stands out so much more to them than my ears. And so you got to be kind of sensitive to who you're running sound for. So that's another key component to that. So 20 hertz is going to be all this stuff down here. The signal path really breaks it up in a couple of four different ways. So we say in your car, it's probably just lows, mids, and highs, right? Or bass, mids, and treble. That's the thing you're most familiar with, where you like just boost the treble and the bass and everything else sounds really good. That's what Bose does. They just boost the treble and the bass and call it Bose. A typical pro audio system will say low frequency, low mid, high mid, and high. So it breaks that mid section up into two sections. And that's really important because those have two very different tonal characteristics. If on an analog console, do you guys have a parametric, a 4 EQ?
Yeah, with a sweepable mids.
Yeah, this one, yeah. So some of the lower end, I know all those Allen and Heaths still have the 4 parametric with the two middle ones are adjustable. Some of the really low end, consumer level audio sound consoles will only just have the 3 adjustments. And that's just, it's unfortunate because it's like they're picking your adjust. It's like buying buying an instrument and like they're putting the sound in it for you. You're not being able to shape it yourself, you know? That's probably not a good analogy, but so what's amazing about this is that, I mean, I can really fully dig into this and say, like, if I'm looking at this right here, that is just below 54 hertz, that is boosted above everything else down here. So if that's like a feedback tone that's happening in my system where a mic's going, I can go dial in exactly 54 hertz and adjust the EQ right on that spot. And so that's what makes it so valuable to have the adjustments very, very specific to this, is I can look in and really dig through and adjust those things very particularly. When I was mixing I got thrown into mixing the first session in there, and that was the first time I heard, I mean, when they started playing was the first time I heard any sound in that system. So I was like, dialing it in, and so the first thing I heard was his voice kind of sounded muddy. So there was like a little bit of a low mid range that was just way too much. So the first thing I did was I went to about 250 in this range right here, and I just scooped a little bit of that out. And what that does is I just, because I've done it a ton of times, I know that low mid is going to be a kind of a nasally sound. And then the second thing I did was when the female vocalist led What a Beautiful Name, it was very bright and very a little bit piercing. A little harsh. Yeah, exactly. And so then I would go to, and again, it wasn't the best it probably could ever sound, but I would go to the high mids. So that high mid section is going to be right in this, and again, this is just basic parameters, right in this like 1K to 1500 range right here. And so that's really going to start scooping some of that harsh sound out of your system. And even if you don't dig into like dialing in exact frequencies, that's fine. But if you know that low frequencies is kind of like that bassy, what's coming out of the subwoofers kind of sound, low mid is the nasally sound. So if it sounds like this, this is probably a problem in your low mid range. High mid is the harsh, shrill, kind of piercing sound. And then highs is that kind of, let me just do it real quick. Where's my keyboard? Up here, and a lot of people will call that like breathiness. If you put it on a vocalist, let me just get something. It just, the breathiness just came out when I just boosted that up. Did you hear that? So that's kind of what that is. So you have a ton of manipulation with an EQ. It's really, a lot of people have called it like the paintbrush of audio, where you can really shape sound and like you said earlier, just manipulate the sound in a way that is sonically pleasing and blends everything together. So a couple of quick things on EQ, because I think it's probably one of the most misperceived tools on the whole system. A lot of people will go and their first adjustment is like, add to the signal what I want it to sound more like, rather than take away what sounds bad or unnatural in that sound signal. And so a lot of times, like, the first adjustment is going to be go to the bass guitar, bass drum, and like boost low end so that it gets a little bit of thump out of your system. But the first thing I typically do on a kick drum is take away like 150 hertz and like take this little boom, boom. And I wish that little subwoofer work was working because I could show you exactly what I mean. And it's not going to sound right anyway. So, all that to say, the right adjustment might be taking something out, like reducing EQ rather than adding to it. Does that make sense? Okay, cool. So, second part of the signal flow is called dynamics. This is controlling just that, the dynamics, the loudness and the softness of a signal. So for say a vocalist, this girl has a really kind of flat voice anyway. I mean, not pitch wise, but just like, let me listen to that. You've all heard like this, the soloist or the soprano voice that like whenever they start really going for it, it just gets from this loud to like this loud. There's that huge dynamic range in the human voice that, oh, Preacher was exactly the point here. So he started off like, and by that last section, he was yelling at me. And I was like, so there's a tool called a compressor on most digital consoles will have this. It is unfortunate that it is difficult to do on an analog system. Not impossible, definitely doable. But do you guys use the compressors at all?
We have compressors on our actual amp. It's a digital amp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of times that's basically like, honestly, if I were running an analog system, I would probably only run it on my main output.
Yeah.
Just to kind of control that total volume. But it's nice to have it on a digital console. It's nice to have because like I could just go to that particular source and kind of start to compress it. And what that essentially does is it, as a signal, let me just show you the diagram here. So if this is the quietest point and this is the loudest point, you know, as a signal, as it gets louder, that we can set a threshold point. And what that threshold point does is, as soon as the signal gets to that loudness, it starts to turn it down for me. It's essentially like the computer is sitting there just turning it down. Every time it gets to a certain loudness, it's just turn it down. It's not a perfect way of saying that, but it is essentially what it's doing is it's just kind of reducing that gain, reducing. And as soon as it gets back below that threshold, it goes right back up. It doesn't change anything else. So it's just boom, boom, boom. And so it just kind of helps blend that together. Does that make sense? So that's essentially what that is. Were y'all running digital consoles at all? Anybody? You have digital. Y'all use a compressor at all?
We had somebody come in and set it up, and he set up some compression, but we hadn't deviated from that.
Yeah, it is a tricky thing. I mean, it took me a while in school just to like mess with it enough to like hear what it's doing and like being able to tell if something's too compressed or whatever. But there's some good rule of thumbs. I mean, if you have a compressor, don't let things compress more than like 3 to 6 decibels on a particular channel. So you can select the channel and like watch the compression level in it. And it'll tell you exactly how much it's kind of reducing in that. If it's just squashing it, like if you have a vocalist that's just squashing, just turn that threshold way up, and that'll open up that signal path more just to give them more space there. And then just kind of pull it back down to where it's just kind of getting that 3 to 6 decibels. That's really all you're kind of looking for in that. So that's another piece of the signal flow. And then from there, we split the signal off. We send it out of our main speaker. We can run through auxes and send it to a bunch of different signal paths. What's really one of the big selling points to me about switching to digital was how great auxiliaries work. On analog console, you're used to everything kind of being in one line of a signal path, and you have your, you know, your Allen and Heath, I think they're like green and yellow, your different auxiliary adjustments. On this, I have my auxes right here. And so what I do is I just hit this button, and that shows me what I'm mixing auxiliary one to be. So if that's my choir monitor, if aux one is my choir monitor, I can see side by side really simply what's being sent to the choir monitor. Because a lot of times it's like this elusive, like there's some noise coming out of the choir monitor that I can't figure out what it is. And it's because you're having to like go through every channel and be like, no, 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 no. And your eyes get crossed and you can't really see really well. But with this, I could just literally hit that button and quickly see across my entire console what's being sent to that choir monitor. And then I can switch to that one. That's aux two, aux three. And I'll hit aux three again and it'll take me back to my main mix. So that's just a really nice feature of a lot of digital consoles, is having these movable faders where I can use my auxes that way. It's just a really sweet way to do that. Really helpful in a lot of ways. And on because they're not limited by space, on like an analog console, you have to have a physical knob for every single one of them. A lot of these consoles will come with like 16 mixes versus 4 or 6 on a typical analog console. So you might not even need that many, but it's so nice to, like, if you want to run inner monitors, every person on the stage, except for a choir, could have a different mix individually. It's really, really excellent way to run things. So the last thing on this is you typically, if you're having trouble understanding how the signal flows through your system, there's typically one of these block diagrams in your manual and in your board, and it's really helpful just to kind of learn. And I know it's a little bit of a geeky way of doing things, but just to kind of learn what all is affecting that signal path as it's going through the system. So again, we've already kind of gone through these things. So it's like where you plug it in, you have your gain knob, your equalizers right there, your faders, and the way it sends out from there to all your different auxiliary places and that sort of thing. So if you see one of these, that's what that is. It's a block diagram just to help you understand what all you're looking at. So any questions about all that stuff? That was the throw lots of information at you. Digest it. So somebody talk to me. What are some of the constant struggles you have with your sound team? Or as a sound guy? What are some things you constantly are battling? You feel like you're having to kind of fight against a lot. We all have them.
My biggest problem is getting people to volunteer.
Yeah?
We've got a lot of older people. And the sound booth is up these steep steps, you know, and so it's hard to get people. It seems like as soon as I get somebody trained, they end up going off to school or something, yeah. You know. So that's been kind of, but I don't know if you can help me with that in this class, but
yeah,
that's my biggest
problem. Well, so I will say, so I was a worship pastor at a church for about 5 years before I came on staff at the mission board, and one of the best things that I did was cross-train on my musicians. And I offered like a master class once in the fall, once in the spring. And I brought in a guy and I taught a class one time or a couple times. And I really kind of asked all my, I didn't make them, but I asked all my musicians to learn audio for one of the reasons that you're kind of talking about. Just so we're all speaking the same language. So if the sound guy gets in the monitor and says, hey, the direct box isn't working, grab a different one. We're like, what's a direct box? I don't know what that is. And so just having a bit of a knowledge of, but what ends up happening is you'll get some of your best audio guys volunteering out of your musician pool. And I know, then you're stealing from Paul to Peter or whatever that phrase is. It's a musician's ear. You have to know it sounds good. And so if you have a rotation of guitar players or a drummer or something like that, that has the musical ear, that has some sort of technical ability, they might end up being a really great sound guy. That can kind of kickstart she just sits in the sanctuary all the time and she's a great musician. Let's bring her up and train her. That kind of building this, disarming like an over ownership piece. Cause I've experienced a lot of churches that have the sound guy that's been there for 30 years, saying, no, you don't touch it. This is the way I've always done it. And I, I like to disarm that as much as possible and say, now this whole, again, the whole point of this booth is to serve the congregation. So we're going to train a lot of people to do this. We're going to try to get the whole team involved and create a bit of a camaraderie around that. So again, I can even come to a class at your church and do that. I would love to do that. So we can talk about that later. That'd be awesome. What else? What about age of equipment? Like, what about, like, do you guys, have you all ever felt the need to purchase new stuff and say, like, this isn't working well, this doesn't sound good? Do y'all have a, is there a tension there in your churches?
For us, this, I'm having to choose which to do. So this year, I'm doing $10,000 on lighting. Not much of anything's going to happen on the, make, I want a digital board, but I can't do both.
Yeah,
the cost is pretty prohibitive. We have a pretty nice system. I've had an LED board for probably 7 years. Before that, they had a Mackie for like 20, you know, all those kind of deals. I'd like to go digital, but I barely got guys who can use the analog board now with the big faders and the knobs to start going to that thing right there. They would never be able to manage it. And my budget's only a few grand a year, so
yeah,
you know, it's tough.
Yeah, no doubt. So that particular console is only $2,400, and it is a solid unit. I've seen very large churches using that exact console, and it serves them well. And as far as the learning factor, I think you'd have an initial resistance, but I think you'd be surprised at how well people find, how much easier people find that. Especially if they own iPhones, they can probably figure this out. And it would be an initial like, whoa, that thing's scary. But as soon as you kind of see it done a couple times, see how it's laid out, like connect the dots from like, okay, remember how this was over here? All you gotta do is hit this and it does this. And then you're gonna get a lot more consistency too, which I know, again, we're kind of dealing with cost more than anything, but one of the hijackers of sound systems is special events, weddings, funerals, that sort of thing. When somebody else brings in their own person, they come in and change everything, right? And with a digital console, I come in on Sunday morning, hit recall Sunday service, everything's back. Exactly. I mean, I saved a little thing earlier. You just hit scenes. And you select the, you know, the one you want and hit recall. Recall, are you sure you want to do that? Yep. That was really loud. Sorry about that. But it puts everything exactly how it was earlier. For my illustration, turned my speakers up all the way. Sorry about that. So it puts everything exactly how, I mean, that's not just my fader levels. That's like my auxes, how I had those, my gain levels, where I had those, my EQs are exactly where I had all of those. So you can freely say, yeah, come in, do your funeral or do your wedding. You change anything you want to change. That's fine. Great. Cool. Boom. Hit recall. You're back to Sunday just like that. And it really is, I'm not here to sell anything. I'm just saying, I know the struggles of ministry and that is one of them. That is so frustrating to get there on Sunday morning and see that everything has changed. And it just ruins your day. Like, that is a day ruiner for me. And that is a ministry ruiner for me, like, just on a Sunday morning. That is, it's tough. So.
Now, when we went from analog to digital, we had a consultant come in and set everything up. And it's actually been a lot easier for the guys. I mean, mostly it's on the faders now.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, and it really makes things that have always been very technical in nature, very visual. So like in EQ, you can see that chart and you can see where the frequencies are bouncing behind it and say, oh, I can touch right there, pull that down and it changes the EQ. It's like, it just makes sense. You know, it's, for instance, in the fact that you can walk around with an iPad and mix from all over the room, I can mix the choir monitors from the choir loft, like, game changer. I mean, it is a game changer. So a lot of these consoles have individual apps for like iPhones. So like, everyone, I set up for National Hills Baptist in in Augusta, I set up a similar console to this, where but I also set up where the band has an iPhone app on their phone, every single one of them, and they just pull up their iPhone app and adjust their levels, and all the channels are labeled on there, like Nick's guitar, Danny's voice, and whatever. And so you just go through and do. They set up their mix, and it sounds perfect to them. You know, if they want to change something, go for it. But here, so like, here's one of the there's a demo version of one of the ones that I use. So it has all the channels laid out side by side. And so if I wanted to select something, I just hit the bank of channels that I want. Mic one, hit that button. There's my dynamics, and I can come over here. The EQ, I mean, I literally, like, here's our spectrum. So 20 hertz to 20K right there. If I wanted to adjust a little bit on low mid, I go boop. I can pull it out and just make that adjustment a little bit wider, just exactly how I want to. So, I mean, it's again, just if you've used an iPhone or iPad or something like that, it's really not a terrible learning curve. So just something to consider.
Make it hard to go back to the analog board this Sunday after seeing all this.
No, I was just thinking about being able to sit in the pews with my wife and mix the.
I do that all the time.
Yeah.
I mix the worship service, worship portion. I'm gonna be close to the faders because it's nice to be able to just grab this quickly, adjust all that stuff. But during the sermon, I mean, she sits kind of like right over there,
and right around a couple the from
yeah.
The booth
or and so I'm, I just walk over there with the iPad in my lap, and I have my Bible over here, my iPad right there, and I'm just.
That'd be nice.
That's cool. Yeah, for sure. What about speakers? Like, what do you guys, do you feel like your speakers cover your room well? Do you feel like they have a good sound to them? Like, if you played a track off of iTunes or something, does it sound great?
The speakers I like, the room I disdain.
Is it?
We've got a bowling alley. We've extended three times, and so now the room is just
lengthwise or widthwise.
Lengthwise, yeah. And it's just terrible. And two, with communication with the soundboard. If me and Jim, sound guy, if he's not on mic and we're either yelling at each other,
which is not a
good feeling, or. Just not understanding what each other is needing.
Yeah, there's a frustration.
Because it's literally a football field. But we've got nice JBLs. And, I don't like the array. And again, that long, I don't know if there's a fix on that. We're right now, a it's kind of a cluster. It's array. Excuse me, array. And we got... four bows in the back section to further it on out.
Yeah.
But not a great... I've seen if we were a taller worship center, I think the where you have the speakers in a straight line, I think that would be nice. But we're feels like a trailer after we're 100 yards.
So is it where it's like much louder in the front of the room than it is in the back of the room?
Yes, and we have a lot of feedback issues because it's a lot of flat surface, a lot of long hauls.
I'm really curious what your room looks like.
Do y'all have windows on the side, or you got blank walls on the side? I mean, what do you get on the sides?
There are 14 windows on the side. Because like I said, it's three times longer than it started out as.
Now 14 on each side or seven on each side?
Seven on each side, yeah. Sorry.
And between the windows, it's just like, what do you got, block walls?
No, it's sheetrock.
Sheetrock.
That's better than block.
Yeah.
It's better than block. I've had brick and block. That's a tough room.
Yeah. No doubt. Just don't do like a brick background on your platform where it's like a cool looking brick. It's like, no, this should be extra slap back. So you do have a JBL line array system?
Yeah.
Cool. That's better than average for sure.
I wonder if you got some more speakers for the back half you know.
Delay system. It sounds like that's what the Bose speakers are doing.
That's kind of what they're doing. But there's not a delay.
There's not a delay.
I don't believe so. I may be wrong, but because I can go through the room and I hear a difference depending on where I am.
Interesting. Yeah, it should be in the system manager, which is like a digital signal processor, which is should be in your amp rack. If there's like an equipment room that has
more of the stuff I never see.
Right, yeah, that room. Where it has a bunch of fans and two knobs in the front of it. There's a processor in there that kind of digitally handles all of that stuff. Okay. And so what it would do is branch off the main signal to your main speakers. You have subwoofers as well?
You talking about the big boom thing? Yeah, there's a thing there. I don't like where it's placed either.
So what it does is it takes that signal.
You're a disgruntled guy, aren't I?
You take that signal and it EQs it in a way that it's only going to give those low frequencies to the subwoofer. But then it should branch it off, the main signal off, and delay it. There's an equation you do for like the distance from this speaker to this speaker, and there's a millisecond delay that should be there, something like 47 milliseconds. That would that when a sound comes out of this one, it's delayed just long enough to, it sounds like it's all time aligned.
It's all time aligned.
If you made a really percussive sound, like if you snapped into a microphone, you would hear it twice. Pa-da-da.
No, we're not that bad.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a lot of times people don't time delay their lobby speakers. And so when you're walking in from the sanctuary, you hear it, you hear a front of the room sound, but it's like you're way back here. Like the church we had last week in Jonesboro, they have amazing production. They spent $1.5 million on their AVL stuff for the church. Insane. It sounds so good in there. Everything's amazing. But he didn't time delay I'm being recorded right now. He didn't time delay his entrance speakers. So like when you're walking from the bathroom and you go to where the doors are, you hear the sound here before it hits the door. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And so it's a bizarre like acoustic psychoacoustic thing where it's like your head's messing with you because it's like is it there? Is it over there? I can't tell. So anyways, that's what that's for. A lot. So the reason I'm asking these questions is I've probably been to 300 Baptist churches in the state of Georgia, and maybe not that many, but it's been a lot of them. And I just find these same kind of recurring things where like the price of a digital console is getting where it's like very affordable, very manageable if you plan for it, and you kind of get there. You get there within a couple of years. Speakers are always a undervalued investment. The way I always try to explain it is, do you have a nice grand piano in your church? Like, have you ever played a Steinway and like felt how good heard how wide the warm the low end of that piano is and how clear the top end is? The materials they build those instruments with matter a lot. The craftsmanship that goes into making that in a certain dimension matters a lot. And just the same way, a speaker cabinet is very much an instrument. And so the way that it reproduces sound is based on the engineering and the materials used. And it's not just stick a thing up there that's making noise. You have to buy a really good sounding piece of equipment that's taking all this musical information that you're giving it and dispersing it evenly and without the harsh tendencies of it. So I've just seen a lot of churches that will spend a lot of money on getting their mixer right, but will ignore their speakers. I would do the opposite. I would buy new speakers before I bought a new console, because you can make an analog console sound great with some good speakers. So anyways, that's that. What else? So fighting feedback. I've heard that a couple times. What? Give me some scenarios where feedback happens in your church.
Well, in our church, our sanctuary. We've only been in it for maybe 6 years now. I forget. It seems like forever, but I think it's only been about 6 years. So we have a fairly new system. And our guys that we had that designed the system, laid out the system, we all worked closely together. In the blueprints, there were this line of speakers here in the apron, just over the choir mics. And I'm like, dude, don't put those there. We're going to get feedback. And I'm like, oh, no, this is great. This is going to work. I'm like, in principle, it doesn't work. I don't understand. So we went ahead and rolled with that because I'm just a sound guy. And that's what we have.
They're the engineer.
Yeah. That's what we have. I can't use those speakers at all.
Those are choir monitors?
Yeah, well,
like top field choir monitors?
Yeah. I think that's what they were designed to be. But I've cut them out as much as I can, considering the way the digital amp and how it pushes everything out. But those choir loft mics are that's the worst. And they're behind our main, so it's not like that's a problem. But if I get any feedback, that's where they're from. And I really can't push them hard enough. I wish I could push them more. But
what kind of choir mics are you using?
I think they're AKGs.
Are they like on the little boom? Like boom,
no, they're
tanks extended from it. Yeah, those are. I find this more difficult because you really don't have a lot of proximity adjustment. Right. You can't put them closer to the group. I've had a lot of luck with the microboom, Audix microbooms.
Yeah.
They're these little skinny black. Let me pull the picture really quick. These are actually pretty pretty miraculous little microphones. I can put them on a piano, they sound great. I can put them on a string section, they sound great. I can put them on acoustic guitar, a mandolin, it sounds great. But they're meant for choir.
I think I've seen them, and I was looking at getting some at the front of my choir since the way that my stuff hangs. I don't always cover all of them. Yeah, I've seen those. Those are great.
So the microphone is just this tiny little capsule right here. I don't know if you can see that. But it's literally, that's all it is. And the rest of it's basically a cable extension where you can get really, it's a very, very light system where I can still suspend over a choir if I want to. But they're basically see-through. So for like Sons of Jubal and that kind of thing, I use them all the time. Because you can buy a very narrow pattern microphone, or you can have a very wide pattern microphone. The wider the pattern, the more susceptible of feedback you're going to be. But what I do with those, and that's how I fight feedback with it really well, is that if you go, like, so if this light right here is that speaker that's pointed at my choir over here, I'm going to go right here. I'm going to put the back end of that microphone at that, and this is going to point the exact in line with that. And what that's going to do is basically reject any sound that's coming from behind it. You still can't put any of that source into the choir monitor just because when you think about speaker placement, think about it like it's a light, like a flashlight. So if you had a really high powered flashlight, and the further you go away, the more it's going to spread out and get wider and less specific. The further, if it's on your ceiling, it's going to hit the walls and the all these different spaces and really kind of create a lot of extra sound we don't want. But if you can get closer to it, you can turn the volume down a tremendous amount, so you're not pushing a lot of sound around the room. So if those choir monitors can get closer, you get that advantage. But I can also manipulate angle of where my microphone is compared to the speaker. Does that make sense? So I agree with you, but you just have to be, I think you're just going to have to be really picky about what you put in there.
Oh yeah, I mean, I can't put the choir in any kind of monitoring system whatsoever that comes back to the choir. I've got some floor monitors that I threw in the loft because
right.
I couldn't run anything else through.
But then you're hitting the front row really hard and the back row can't hear?
No, I got them halfway in.
Okay,
there you go. I'm getting them both sides. But, so we've got that going on. But earlier you asked, what kind of fight are you fighting? Biggest, and just brought it to mind when you said Sons of Jubal. I did audio for them at our church a few years back, and they came in and said, man, these monitors are like turned up to 20. I'm like, yeah, that's my choir. And a lot of them are older, and not saying anything, but they're older. And we can't hear. We can't hear the music. We can't hear anything. I'm like, yeah, you can. It's really loud because I can pull the mains down, and I can still run this service with your monitors.
Yeah.
So that's the fight that I thought.
Yeah, I was helping a lady. She's a choir director in North Georgia, and I mean, she asked me to come in and help their sound. They were preparing for Christmas, and a guy came in like October, November, one of the rehearsals for that. And it's just like, we just can't, they're just saying they can't hear very well in the congregation. And I walked back there, and like as they're rehearsing, I just literally turned the mains off, and nothing changed.
Right, yeah.
Nothing changed, because the monitors are just so loud. And so, just as a sound guy, his job is to serve the congregation and kind of be behind the scenes and selfless about all that stuff. I have to preach to choirs a lot to do as little as you can. It's not going to be your Bose headphones blasting in your head. You're not going to hear that well, period. You got to accept that fact and say, okay, we're going to turn that down as little as we can so that we can serve our congregation. And that's got to, that can't necessarily come from you. That's got to come from a music minister. But
yeah.
Like, if you can communicate that way, that well to your music minister in a way that he can kind of champion that effort, make that his fault, not yours.
Yeah. that is the biggest, that's the biggest issue that we have. We have a nice sounding room. We have a JBL array and the 18 subs up there. And
cool.
All that, man. I mean, I've run concerts and there's a great sounding room, but, those little things like that just drive me nuts. And finding volunteers, I can't get anybody to do it. I've got three guys. I had four for a few years, and one's gone. And I can't get anybody else in. They won't volunteer. It's not hard. It's really not.
Yeah.
It's a lot of hours.
One Sunday a month. One Sunday a month. Come on, you can go. One Sunday a month.
Where's your church?
Waynesboro.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have any college campuses nearby? Waynesboro is closer to Augusta, right?
Yeah, we don't have anything. We have a Augusta Tech campus, but I mean that's mostly local guys anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And no real colleges within 30 minutes. So
yeah, I always use my youth ministry as a farming ground for.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Sorry, you're about to see pictures of my family. I always use youth ministry as a farming ground for that kind of thing, and kids pick it up like that. I mean, how long have you been doing all this stuff?
3 years. So.
How old are you?
20.
Yeah. So you started when you're 17.
Yes, sir.
Okay. In my experience, those are the guys I'm like, you pick it up like that, learn it, knock it out of the park.
Those are my video guys, man. I got a 15-year-old, so they're saying, hey, come on, man. You know, learn how to run these slides. Learn how to run this
yeah.
system.
So, again, like, those master classes, I don't know what it is, but, it's like I'm tricking people into running sound. Because, like, I'm just asking my band to learn, but just invite a couple extra people, you know? And it's, like, because there's a critical mass of, like, band guys there, it's like, oh, okay, that's actually kind of cool. If you can just get a couple extra folks there, you'll get I typically walked away with two or three more volunteers, which is
you may
double.
Come and teach a master class.
Do it.
I got some kids, so you can
do it. And advertise. I mean, just have your youth pastor advertiser or whatever. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like that. Kids want to get involved, and I think that's a cool way to do it. And people think they have to have expertise in it already, but like, just I mean, if you advertise in a way that's like, do you know how to turn the volume up on your iPhone? Okay, we can work with that. It's okay. What else? Anything else? Anything that I kind of breezed through? I mean, I blew through all that stuff. Any of that didn't make sense that I can clarify or anything? No? You got it all now. Cool. Well, happy to discuss anything else. Please know that, I mean, as a staff member of the mission board, my job is to serve your churches. So please let me know if I can ever come and help. And I travel the whole state and do this kind of stuff, do contemporary worship stuff, and am glad to help in any way I can. Okay. Yeah.